Hey everyone, Mark Moses here. Welcome to a very special episode of the Make Big Happen podcast. You know, I talk a lot about the principle that's guided my entire career, that nobody wins alone. And today's episode is a perfect example of that. For the past 11 years, my good friend, Steve Sandusky, architected and was the heart of CEO Coaching International podcast. He sat across from hundreds of CEOs, founders, and business leaders asking the tough questions, pulling out the insights, and helping us all become better at what we do. I don't think most of our listeners realize just how much Steve has shaped what this show has become. So today, we're going to flip the script. Steve's not going to be the one asking the questions. I am. Because after more than a decade of conversations with some of the most successful leaders in the world, Steve has accumulated a lot of wisdom and pattern recognition that I want to mine today for all of you. In this episode, I want to do two things. First, I want to publicly thank Steve for an incredible 11 years. And second, I want to give you, our listeners, something valuable. The biggest lessons Steve has learned from his front row seat to an incredible range of leaders. Entrepreneurs building from scratch, CEOs scaling their companies, executives running private equity portfolio companies, founders who have successfully exited, and all of our world-class coaches. A truly diverse group, but all focused on the same things, the lessons they learned on their journeys as leaders. Steve, thank you for being here today, and thank you for everything you've done over the last 11 years. Our guests have loved you, and I've loved listening to your episodes where you really dig in and bring out the best in all of those that you interview, looking for those nuggets.
Well, Mark, I appreciate that very nice opening. It's been a tremendous privilege of mine to be at the helm here of the podcast for the last 11 years and to work closely with you and the team and all the great coaches at CEO Coaching International. So, yeah, so I'm looking forward to having the conversation and having the tables turned on me this time where I'm on the hot seat instead of putting other people on the hot seat. So this is going to be fun.
Well, let's get at it then. So you've had a front row seat to hundreds of conversations with some of the most successful CEOs and entrepreneurs in the world. So before we dig into specifics, how has this experience changed Steve Sandusky and who you are as a person?
Yeah, well, it's been eye-opening and it's been humbling. And I would say that if we go back to the early days of the podcast, I was thinking that we were going to talk a lot about marketing and about growth and about tactics and about strategies and, you know, all the nuts and bolts of how do you build a really successful business. And of course, we did talk about a lot of those things. But I think one of the things that really changed me was just how much pressure entrepreneurs and CEOs are under. And if we look at what's happened over the past decade or so, of course, we've got COVID in the middle of that. And we had so many great conversations during that period of time when you know, we didn't know what was going to happen and, you know, how businesses were going to respond and the world sort of shuts down. And so just the weight of the job of being a CEO and how lonely it can be at the top and just the humanness that leaders had to show up as during some of these most difficult moments. And so I think that to me was very humbling. It gave me even greater respect for the role of a CEO, for the role of an entrepreneur, and just how much they have to deal with, the pressure that they're under, and how they were able to overcome that. So I think that's probably one of the biggest things that's changed me is just humbling and just even greater respect for what these leaders do.
Yeah, Steve, I think this comment that you just mentioned now about the pressure they are under is only going to accelerate here now with the AI in the last 18 months, even the last 12 months, has accelerated at such a pace. I remember when I started playing with ChatGPT, maybe October of maybe we'll call it 15, 16 months ago or so. And it was clunky. It was still just getting going. And I know it had been around for a while but prior to that. But now the pressure that CEOs are under, and to have Diamandis continue to say this concept about there'll be two kinds of companies, those that have fully embraced AI or those that will be out of business here in the coming years before the end of this decade. How do you feel today, Steve, or what have you seen about this impact, this acceleration of AI and how it will impact businesses?
Well, yeah, really several things there. So one is you can't ignore it. Obviously, I think that's sort of a no-brainer. And so I spent a lot of time using AI. In fact, OpenAI, ChatGPT, at the end of last year, early this year, they gave people sort of your year with ChatGPT. And when I got my summary in January of 2026, it showed that I was in the top 3% of all users of ChatGPT. So, I mean, I was sort of a power user of it. So I'm like, I got to dig into this thing. And so I think there's tremendous power, but I also think there's tremendous concern. And so there's definitely a concern of, is AI going to do to the white collar workforce what globalization did to the blue collar workforce? And so I think we're going to have this huge transition period where AI is going to be transformational, but we've got to figure out, well, what are going to be the other costs related to that? And so I think that is one of the things that's going to make a leader's job, I think, much more difficult. We may get into this a little bit later, but even much more difficult over the coming decade. Even though the past decade's been pretty difficult, I think AI is going to be one of the key things that's going to make a leader's job even more difficult going forward.
Steve, the pressure today on kids graduating from college and all these, we'll call them white-collar jobs or these dream jobs that were once coveted by college students, are becoming less and less available. And it appears that that will continue to be the case. And I also read that search firms may even begin flipping the script in that today they're hired by companies looking for people. But being that there's so few jobs and more candidates, I have read that search firms, in order to compete, may flip it and will be hired by people, these students coming out of college looking for jobs, the opposite of what's been done historically. How do you feel about that issue and the impact that AI is going to have on these kids coming out of colleges and how it will impact businesses in terms of the search for talent?
Well, I think one of the most pressing issues related to that is, how are people going to get the entry-level job skills that are required to advance to the higher-level functioning that's required to run organizations? So, for example, we've been reading about how AI is now making like first-year law associates obsolete because AI can do all the research and can do all the case research and everything to figure out, you know, where are the precedents. In financial services, where I spend time, there's a lot of concern about how AI can now put together financial plans, and AI can listen in on your meeting with a client, and it can put together the review notes, and it can analyze what was discussed. It can identify what were the concerns that the client was expressing, and it can put together the summary email that you send out to the client, when normally an entry-level person would be sitting in on the meeting with the financial advisor. They'd be taking the notes, they'd be summarizing, and it's a way for them to learn how to do the job, how to put a financial plan together. And so there's a big concern, I think, across many industries. How are we going to train entry-level people if we've got AI that can do it 24 hours a day at basically just the cost of electricity? So I think that's a huge challenge that we're going to have to face. And I think it gets back to this idea of AI is clearly going to have a transformational impact on the workforce. And we just have to be very careful about how we manage that transition so that it doesn't, you know, create other social problems that that we don't want to have to deal with.
I was also reading that as it relates to surgeries, that almost all surgeries in the future will be done by robotics. So why go to med school for 100 years to become a surgeon when you're going to be obsolete? If you went started today, you're probably obsolete by the time you graduated. Crazy, crazy time.
Well, it is. And remember, not long ago, people were saying, learn how to be a coder, learn how to program computers, learn software. And now it's like AI can write your software for you, and it's making coders obsolete. And so now we have to go one or two or three layers above that in terms of we've got to be able to know what to ask the AI, what to prompt it. We've got to know what whether the output that it's giving you is accurate or not. In fact, one of the things that I think is going to be is interesting, and maybe this is counterintuitive when it comes to AI, is that I think the people who are going to be most successful in using AI are the ones who are the subject matter experts in the area where they're using AI. And what I mean by that is, A, you've got to know what to ask it. And then B, you've got to be able to discern whether or not the output that AI is giving you is actually accurate. If it's something novel that like, wow, I'm an expert in my field. I hadn't even thought of that. That's an interesting angle. I'm going to go down that path and let's see where that leads, because this could be a complete breakthrough that we hadn't even thought of before. Or C, is it just hallucinating? And so I think it still makes sense that we have to be experts in what it is that we do. And then we can use the AI to leverage, to augment who we are as humans. And so it takes away a lot of the rote work that we may have used to have to do. And now we're using only the things that humans can do. But again, the tricky part is we can't miss the building blocks to get to the level of expertise. And so that's really the hard part is I think we still need both, but AI makes it easy to skip that first part, those building blocks.
That's a fair point. I think the next year and 2 years will be very exciting to see how entrepreneurs and companies adapt to these changes. Let me move you back to after 11 years and all the conversations that you've had with our guests, what's the one trait you've seen in virtually every CEO who builds something truly significant? The thing that if it were missing, nothing else matters.
Can I give you two?
Oh, sure. You're going to do it anyway, so go okay. For it.
Well, you know, I want to ask for permission here. Well, the first one I'd say is coachability. And I don't want that to sound self-serving. This is the CEO Coaching, the Make Big Happen podcast, and you're a coaching company. So I don't want to make that sound self-serving, but it is true. And what I mean by that is the most successful leaders, the most successful entrepreneurs, they're not the ones who know it all. You know, they're the ones who really want to learn it all. And so I think this idea of they're lifelong learners, they have the humility to know that I don't know everything. And so they want to keep learning. They also have a great relationship to feedback, because oftentimes these leaders are strong personalities, but the ones who I think are really the most successful are the ones who know that, okay, I may have some traits that have helped me be super successful, but if I don't watch out for those are also the traits that are going to be my downfall. And so they've got to have a little bit of that strength of personality combined with the humility to know that, yeah, I'm probably going to have to evolve over time if I want to keep growing as my company grows. So I think that ability to be coachable, to understand, to accept feedback, to adjust based on that feedback, I think that's a very, very important trait. So I'd say that's probably the first one. And the second one is about the team. And I want to share a story from Rick Sapio. I know you know Rick. Rick has since passed away, I believe it's from cancer. And he was super brave during that time when he was dealing with cancer. And so that's a whole nother story. But I did a podcast with Rick. And one of the things that he mentioned that I think is very relevant here is he spent years interviewing billionaires. And he over those years, he interviewed more than 40 billionaires. And one of the stories that he shared with me was from one of the billionaires who said that he's saying, here's the difference between a billionaire, and the billionaire was pointing to himself, and you, Rick, the millionaire. And he was pointing at Rick. He said, the difference is a billionaire, when they've got an idea, they make sure that they get the right person to take this idea and start running with it. And so the very first thing they do is, I want to get the right person in place to make this idea actually happen. And he said, by contrast, a millionaire, you, Rick, what you do is, oh, I got to build a website. Oh, I got to come up with a marketing plan. I got to build a prototype. I got to do this. I got to do that. So it's like all the little detail stuff, which of course is important. And somebody's got to do that. But if you do it, then you're sort of the millionaire because you get caught up in all those details. Whereas a billionaire is like, I'm going to get the right people in place to really execute and move forward on this. And so I thought that was, you know, a really insightful point that if you don't start with the right leader, then really you're designing the business to be dependent on you. And if the business is dependent on you, then the business can't scale any further than you can actually grow yourself. And so, you know, this billionaire, he really saw himself not as an operator, but really more as an architect, someone who's going to set the direction for the business, someone who selects the leaders and creates leverage through other people. And so it's, you know, it's really this reminder that leadership isn't about being busy. It's about building something that's going to succeed and grow without you at the center of it.
Well said. Rick Sapio's episode, if you pushed me and said, Mark, what was your favorite episode? I would go with that one. And the way I remember that one, and Rick and I were very, very close friends for about 30 years. The way I interpreted or recall that episode was he said, millionaires do, billionaires point to others to do. And that's probably what you're describing as the architect.
Absolutely.
So let's move to what's the biggest myth about successful CEOs that these conversations have completely shattered for you?
Well, I think the myth is that they've got it all figured out. And they don't. I mean, I've been fortunate in a lot of these conversations that the CEOs and the entrepreneurs, they're very candid and they express the times when they had doubts. And, you know, oftentimes it happens when they first become a CEO or they realize that, oh my gosh, the whole weight of this organization is on my shoulders. And in many cases, they've never been a CEO before. And so it's like, how do I do this job if I've never been in this position before? And so they have doubts like a lot of the rest of us do. But you know, eventually they figure it out. And they figure it out because they put the systems in place. They have a cadence of meetings. They have a vision. They have an annual plan. They have goals. They have activities. They have accountability. They have KPIs. And so they put all that structure in place to make sure that they've got a path and they've got a discipline to follow through. And so I think ultimately it's that, you know, success doesn't come from certainty. Success doesn't come from having all the answers, but it's really more about a structured execution. It's more about making sure that you're surrounding yourself with other people. And so I'm not going to have all the answers, but I bet I know someone who does. And I'm going to surround myself with other key players on my team who are experts in their area, so that in total, as a team, we can really execute and be successful. So I think that was really one of the keys that they don't always have it all figured out, but they surround themselves with people who together they can help figure it out.
And you've talked to CEOs at every stage from scrappy startups to those with billion-dollar exits. What surprised you the most, Steve, about the problems and how they change as company scales? What problems never really go away, no matter how big a company gets?
Yeah, I think what changes over time is the complexity. And so you think about the beginning of a company, really the early stages, it's about survival, right? It's like, okay, I got this idea and I think it's going to work, but is it really going to work? And so you go out into the marketplace, you bootstrap, you borrow money, you maximize, you know, max out on your credit cards. And you just hope that this thing is going to work. So I think in the early days, it's really about survival and trying to find, you know, the product market fit and making sure you've got something that will work. And then once you've sort of reached that point where you're like, okay, the marketplace is saying, yeah, this is a good idea. And this is something that we're willing to pay money for. And now the business is growing. You've got a lot of people there. And so now it shifts from, I think, survival mode to more about how can I build this business and design this business in such a way that it is going to be sustainable and it's going to scale. So now we're really talking about culture issues. We're talking about operations. We're talking about leaderships and developing C-suites. We're talking about annual meetings and weekly, monthly meetings and cadences and KPIs and accountability and all those things. And so I think that then becomes the key measure on whether you're going to stay just a small business where you're at the top and you're the bottleneck, or whether you're going to be able to scale beyond you and you're going to expand the team and you're going to put the systems in place that are going to allow you to be successful long-term. And so I'd say that's sort of the difference between, you know, the early days and the later days. And then in terms of what isn't going to change over time, what some of those fundamentals are, I think those are fairly obvious in terms of you've got to have that vision. You've got to have that annual plan. And then you got to take the annual plan and break that down into quarterly goals. And then each quarter identify, okay, well, what are the initiatives here? And what are the specific activities that we've got to do to actually achieve these quarterly goals? And the quarterly goals have to roll up to the annual plan. And then the annual plan has to be in service of the longer term vision that you have for the business. And so I've seen it as it's sort of a top down big picture, like this is where we're going. This is the North Star. But then it's also a bottoms up in terms of here's where we want to be several years down the road. Here's where we are right now. And now we need to have a disciplined process that's going to get us closer and closer and closer to that ultimate vision that we have. And so I think, so that's important. Of course, we've got to have the right people in the right seats. We also have to make sure that we're staying close to the customer. We've got to execute, and we just got to be real, real clear. And again, touched on the culture here a little bit ago as well. So that the culture becomes more important as the company grows, because your ability to be a leader is going to be multiplied if you've created a culture that encourages and incentivizes each team member to perform in a way that is going to benefit the organization and is going to help the organization reach that North Star that it sets. So culture, I think, becomes even more important as organizations get bigger and bigger.
What's something you now believe about business success that would have shocked you when you started this podcast 11 years ago?
I would say that would be that most growth problems are actually leadership problems in disguise. And what I mean by that is if we go back years ago, I would say that, hey, if the company's not growing fast enough, then really it's a marketing problem, or it's a sales problem, or maybe it's a product market fit problem. So let's just throw some more money at it and let's do some more ads, or let's do more of this or more of that. And let's sort of reignite the growth again. And yes, that's true, of course. I mean, that's certainly part of the equation. But I think ultimately, it's less about those specific things, and it's more about the discipline behind everything. And again, I keep hammering on this idea of having that vision and having the annual plan and having the goals and the KPIs and the meeting cadence. It's like, that's the discipline, you know, that's the leadership disciplines that when you have those in place, it gives you the mechanism and it gives you the framework that if sales are starting to slow, you're going to get an early warning indicator on that. And you're going to make those adjustments along the way because you've got the cadence, you've got the reports, you've got the leading indicators, you're seeing the lagging indicators. So you're tracking all of that. So you're going to catch this stuff early and you're going to make adjustments along the way. So to me, it's really about a leadership issue if growth is stalling. And not so much about, oh, we just got to have better tactics or strategies, or, you know, tweak the product a little bit and more people are going to buy it.
Was there ever a guest who said something that made you think that can't be right? And then you realize that they may have been onto something that people miss.
Yeah. And I would say culture. And I know I probably talked a lot about culture here, but I would say early on, I mean, of course, I knew culture was important. But culture is one of those things where it's easy to just roll your eyes when someone talks about it, because they say, oh, yeah, we got a great culture and we've got values and we've got this plaque up on the wall. And every day we come into the office and we look at the plaque and we sort of bow down and nod and say, yes, these are wonderful values and we love our vision and all that. And if that's all the farther that you go with that, well, then, yeah, roll your eyes, because that isn't going to help you at all. But in many of the conversations over the past 11 years, they talk about the importance of culture. And I am absolutely a believer in the importance of culture and how if you intentionally create a culture and design a culture that is designed in a way that is going to lead you toward that vision that you have for the firm, then the culture is going to do a lot of the heavy lifting for you as a leader, meaning that the environment itself is shaping the behavior of everyone there. Because you as the leader, you can't be everywhere at all times. And so you have to know that the people are going to do the work that's necessary to move the company forward and help it achieve its goals. And to me, culture is that piece that really does a lot of that heavy lifting. And if you can have, I'll call it the right culture for your firm, for what you're trying to build, again, that's going to do a lot of the heavy lifting. And so it made me realize that culture is not a layer on top of the company. It's really the operating system for the business. And so I really encourage people to really think about that culture, continue to reinforce that culture, and it's going to help hold people accountable. It's going to help shape the behavior of people when no one else is looking. So I think that's going to be a super key here is the culture piece.
Steve, I totally agree with you. And I'd like to say that when companies are having a tough time and are trying to navigate a decision, I often like to ask them, and I've learned from some of the best, what value are we talking about? One of our core values are we using to help us or guide us to make that decision? And the companies that use their values to help them make the decision, I think are the ones that are the most successful. Because like you said about values, some people hang them on a wall and some use them. They use them successfully and some do not. But let's say, for example, if one of their values was courage and they were dealing with a courageous decision based on our values, how do we use our value of courage to guide us on this decision? And I've seen that to be very helpful for firms trying to navigate some of the real hard decisions, even the value of integrity when they're dealing with something really tough. And when using that value to guide them, really helps them make the right decision.
100%. I think that's such an important point about values is that it's a filter for decision-making. And to your point, when you've got a tough decision to make, go back and ask yourself, okay, if we're living our values, what decision would our values tell us to make? And so I think that's critical. And then a second thing related to that, I would say, is there's a hierarchy of values. So a firm may have five values, but they may not all be equally weighted. And there will be situations that arise when two values may be in conflict. And so again, gets back to as a leader, you have to discern, okay, in this situation, which of these two values is going to take precedent? Because both values are important to us, but they're in conflict based on the situation that we're facing. And so again, I think leaders' jobs are hard. And that's another example when values are conflict, which one's going to take precedence?
I'm really glad you brought that up because that's true. And many leaders do face that. Speaking of hard things, we talk about a lot of wins on the show. And you've talked about for 11 years and asked winners about how they won along the way. But you've also heard CEOs open up about their hardest moments. And with or without naming names, what have you learned about how the best leaders handle failure or doubt or moments when they themselves wanted to quit?
Well, I'm going to name names here because she was on the podcast and she shared the story and it's in one of the Make Big Happen books as well. So someone we both know and love, Sarah Dusick. And Sarah started a company with her husband called Under Canvas, which is a glamping company. And she shared a story, I believe it was like in 2012 when this actually happened. It was early days in their glamping business. And she was at her camp just outside of Yellowstone National Park. They had, I think, maybe 25 of these tents that were set up safari-like high-end glamping tents. And she had a 3-year-old and a 9-month-old at the time. And she's looking at the sky and she's noticing, oh my goodness, it looks like a storm is coming in. Well, sure enough, a storm did roll in. So she's in the car holding her 2 kids with her. Her husband was out of town at another event. This massive storm rolls through like a hurricane and just flattens the whole camp. And so she's sitting in the car crying with her 2 kids thinking, oh my gosh, this is it. This is the end. We're done. You know, we hardly even got started and now the business is over because our whole camp is just flattened here. Now she could have just, you know, sat there and just bawled the rest of the night and just, you know, felt pity for herself. But very quickly she decided, okay, I've got 2 choices here. I can either fold up my tent, you know, literally or figuratively here and go home and say, okay, I tried that and it didn't work, or regroup and figure out how to make this happen. And so ultimately she obviously chose the latter, and within hours, everyone there pitched in. The team members that she had with her there, all of the campers, they all pitched in. They got all those tents put back up together again and made it work. And many of the people that were there that night came back and became repeat customers. And so it's just, you know, it's not so much about what happens to you as it is how do you respond to what happens to you. And I just love that story from Sarah. And just a second one related to her is, and you're going to remember this one well, Mark, she came to the CEO Coaching Summit in 2018, and each person who attended was given a glass, you know, it's kind of piece there. And on the glass, it had the phrase, what do you want? And she shared a story afterwards. She said, I got that. And for the next 3 days, I was at home and I looked at that and I asked myself, well, what really do I want? And so it was a monumental question for her. And she decided, she figured out what she wanted. She worked with her coach. I think she was working with Sheldon Harris. And within a year or two, she ended up selling the company. And I think they got like a 32X multiple of EBITDA. And it was just an amazing story. And so to me, it was such a full circle time in that she shared that initial story about the storm flattening their tents and nearly giving up, to just, you know, not long after that, selling the business for a huge multiple. So yeah, it's that resilience, I think, is really key there.
I'm glad you brought that story up. That is a great story. And I had a feeling you might go there with that one. She ended up selling that business for $100 million, which was the answer to the question, what do I want? And she said, I want to sell my business for $100 million and be up on the Make Big Happen Summit stage sharing that story, which is exactly what she ended up doing. The power of the question, what do you want? Let me move to Steve. What's the loneliest part of being a CEO that came through in these conversations that most people outside that seat would never really understand?
Well, let me share another story here. And this was one of the episodes that I think really affected me the most. And it was with Frank DeJong. And at the time, as Frank told me the story, it goes back to when he was working overseas. I think he may have been in Singapore, somewhere in Asia. And while there, he had a couple of younger kids, and his wife died of cancer while he was overseas. And so here he is. He's this executive. He's running a big division of a large company. He's got hundreds of people that he's responsible for leading. And now his wife passes away, and he's got 2 young kids. It's like, what are you going to do? And of course, he could have quit. He could have gone a lot of different directions. But what he ultimately decided to do is that he just had to really narrow down what was important to him. And so he said, I really narrowed it down to 2 things. One of which was, I got to be here for my kids. You know, obviously they need me now more than ever. And so I got to be there for my kids. And the second thing is, he said, I got this business too, and I want to run that. I can't let all these other people down because I've had this tragic situation happen to me. And so he really focused on his kids and he focused on running the business. And what he also did was he leaned on other people. He was not afraid to ask for help. He had caregivers that would help him with his kids. He had people at work that were able to sort of pick up the slack if his kids were having a difficult time and he needed to spend more time with them. And so I think that one of the things that we often don't understand is, what is that leader going through? Now, in Frank's case, it was an extreme situation with his wife passing away. But all of us have bad days for different reasons. We don't know what someone is going through when they may be acting out, or maybe they're doing something that's like, wow, that doesn't seem like, you know, the person that I know, sort of thing. And so the challenges and the pressures that these leaders have is just off the charts. And so, again, I think it just gets back to me having even more respect for what these people go through, because they have personal lives like we all do. And on top of that, they've got the weight of all these other people that work for them on their shoulders as well, that they're responsible for. So I think in Frank's case, you know, it was a great reminder that leadership isn't about avoiding breakdowns. It's about learning how to lead through them without losing yourself or losing the people that are relying on you as well.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that story about Frank. For our listeners, Frank today is just an awesome coach here at CEO Coaching International. We're lucky to have him. And what he went through was incredible, incredibly difficult. And watching him go through that and come back from that is really remarkable. It reminds me, too, of what Rick Stern went through. Carol Clinton, who ended up passing away after her third bout with cancer, very, very tough for the families and for themselves as they're going through these really tough periods. So if you, Steve, had to distill down 11 years of conversations into three non-negotiable disciplines every CEO should have, what would they be?
Well, I think these are very similar to what's in the two books there, Make Big Happen and Making Big Happen. So one of them certainly would be to just have, I'll call it strategic clarity, and just really translate that into priorities. So that's really about, you know, having a vision is not enough. Having a strategy is not enough. You've really got to have, you know, everything below each of those. You've got to have the activities that you need to be doing on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly basis that are going to lead to those results. You've got to follow through on everything. And so really, I would say number one is having that strategic clarity that's translated into actionable things that you can do on a day-to-day basis. A second thing is the whole meeting cadence process. So again, going back to having the big annual planning meeting and having the quarterly review meetings and having the monthly review meetings and the weekly meetings with your leadership team. It's like having that whole structured process of meetings so that you're reviewing what's happened, but you're also talking about what's going to happen and you're catching any problems early and you're holding people accountable. So I think that whole execution process is going to be a key. And then I would say the third, of course, is the talent, and that you've got to be really relentless in making sure that you've got the right people on the team. You've got the wrong people off the team. And Mark, I've heard you say this before. You've asked, you know, an audience the question of, when was the last time you fired somebody too soon? And I've also heard you say that the longest period of time in a leader's life is the time between when you decide to fire someone and when you actually fire them. And so again, really gets back to this idea that you cannot have any weak links on the team. You've got to have a team that's made up of top performers and top team players. So again, it's not just, oh, these are great performers, but if they're just performing in isolation and they're not team players, that's another problem as well. So we've got to have great players who are also great on the team as well. So I would say those would be three real key things.
Yes, Steve, thank you. As you were saying that, it reminded me of Jim Collins, who spoke at the Make Big Happen Summit last year, that 4 hours of intensity from him was amazing. But he was talking about the flywheel, and he was having everybody in the audience go through and prepare their own flywheel and challenge it. And he would say, I guess each turn of the flywheel from one step to the next needs to be automatic or the entire flywheel stops working. And for most people, they have this one spot in the flywheel where it's not automatic that ends up destroying the acceleration of the entire flywheel. Anyway, you made me think of that as you were describing that.
Yeah, and that was one of the highlights too. I mean, you've been doing the CEO Coaching International Summit for many years now, and Jim Collins was a recent keynote speaker there. And as you mentioned, he did a multi-hour session, and that was a phenomenal session. Another great example of how you're really bringing together some of the best leaders out there, and we get hundreds of people that come to those summits each year, and they're continuous learners. And that was a great example there.
Steve, I think you've been to all of them over the years, and it has been great having you there, from President Bush to Jesse Itzler to Peter Diamandis to Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, and many of the clients of CEO Coaching International who've had their own incredible stories and shared their stories and their rise and fall and rise again. Speaking of these, what question do you wish more CEOs would ask themselves that almost none of them do?
I would say, what is it that only I can do? And why am I still doing all this other stuff? So it just gets back to, you're the leader, you're the founder, you're the CEO, because you had some kind of special sauce or something that you can do pretty much better than anybody else. And so, you know, spend your time doing that and all this other stuff that someone else can do, most likely do a lot better than you, let them do that. And so I think that's another key trait of the most successful leaders, is that they're willing to let go. They're willing to stop doing things that they know someone else can do, but because they're a control freak, they continue to do it. Well, if that's who you are, your business is going to hit a ceiling, because you're going to be the ceiling on the growth of that business. So yeah, I'd say identify what you're best at, and then surround yourself with other people who are great at those things that you're not great at, and then work as a team. That's when you're really going to get some leverage.
Love that, and totally agree, and seen it over and over again. And those that actually break out are those that empower others to do what they can do best, which is often better than the CEO or entrepreneur can, and focused on their highest and best use. So of all the episodes we've done together, Steve, which conversation has stuck with you the longest, that you kept thinking about it for weeks or months later, and why?
Well, I think I've actually mentioned a couple already. So one was with Frank. I think his episode talking about the passing of his wife and how he had to deal with that, that is certainly one that has stuck with me. And then the Rick Sampio episode has certainly stuck with me. And another just kind of quick story from Rick that he shared on the podcast was he was very clear on what was important to him. And he related that by sharing the story. He said, just imagine that you're in a room. You're only going to let into that room the people that you want to be with for the rest of your life. And so he said, you have someone outside the front of that door, and you tell them, look, these are the things that are important to me. These are my values. And anyone that wants to come into this door, into my world, they need to sort of like pass this test, okay? And so he was very clear on what he wanted and what he didn't want. And so he really organized his life around that idea. And I thought that was an idea that has really stuck with me as well, is, and he also came up with a filtering system. And so he said, whenever I have a new opportunity that's presented to me or a new opportunity that I'm thinking about, I run it through a filter. And so one of his filters was leverage, meaning, okay, if I do this idea, does it give me the ability to leverage my business? Another filter was probability, which is, okay, what's the probability that this thing that I'm thinking about doing is going to be successful and can grow in the way that I want to. And so he had, you know, several of these little filters for big decisions that he would make, sort of like the values idea as well. So I thought Rick was a genius in that way, with these different sort of mechanisms and frameworks that he used. And of course, his life was cut short, way too short, and we all miss him. But his memory is certainly going to live on in all the great wisdom that he shared over time.
He clearly, Rick Sapio, was a learn-it-all and definitely not a know-it-all. And he did provide a lot of wisdom. It's really interesting reflecting on some of that wisdom he did provide all of us. Given everything you've learned, what advice would you give CEOs listening right now about the next decade and what it's going to demand from them?
I think the next decade for CEOs is probably going to be the one that's going to test them more than any other decade, at least probably in my lifetime. And I say that because I think a lot of the things that we've been able to rely on in recent decades are starting to falter, whether it's governments, whether it's courts, whether it's global trade systems, whether it's even social norms. I mean, some of the things that we thought were kind of stable, I think are starting to crack. And this is not just a U.S. phenomenon. I mean, this is like a worldwide thing. And so I think that's going to be difficult to navigate. And so the one piece of advice that I would give around that is, and this is something that I personally have been doing now for the past couple years, and that is I've been really thinking about this idea of polarities. And so for the past 2 years, each January, I've started the year with coming up with three polarities. And a polarity is it's basically two words or two ideas that to some extent might seem kind of opposite. So think of like yin and yang as an example. Okay. Those are sort of opposite polarities, but we need both. And we need to integrate both, and we can't over-index on one. So if we spend all of our time on one side and then on the other, it's going to lead to not a good outcome. So let me give you a couple examples if you want. I'll start with this first one, which is, Mark, I know you're a big boater. So you've got a yacht, make big happen. You like to spend a lot of time on the water. I happen to be a sailboat guy, and so I spend a lot of time on sailboats. Well, one of my polarities for this year is compass, wind, those two words. And so if you think about sailing, you can hand steer, but there comes a time when you're probably going to get kind of tired of that. And so at that point, you've got a couple main options. One is you can press the button for the autopilot, which uses electricity. And with the autopilot, you're going to say, okay, I want to go 270 degrees. That's where I want to go, which would be due west. And with that autopilot, it's going to keep you sailing 270 degrees, regardless of what happens to the wind, regardless of what happens to the sea state, it's going to keep you going 270 degrees. On the other end, you could use wind vane steering, which doesn't use electricity, and instead it uses the wind to determine where you're going to go. So you would basically say, I want to sail 90 degrees off of the wind. So what happens then, as the wind shifts directions, your boat's going to go a different direction because it's always going to stay 90 degrees off of whatever the wind is today. So to me, this idea of compass wind, as this relates to leaders, is I think we're going to have to hold this idea of there are times when I want to put my compass heading in and I want to go 270 degrees, I want to go due west. And there are times when the wind shifts, when things happen, when rules change, where I'm going to have to shift based on what's happening in the environment. So the discernment is going to come in for leaders is determining when do I stick to my compass heading and when am I going to shift based on which way the wind is blowing here. So I think that's going to be a critical skill. That's going to be it. I mean, it's always been a critical skill, but I think it's going to be even more important as we go forward. So I think this idea of compass wind and having discernment, I think it's going to be a key trait that's necessary to succeed going forward.
I love the analogy, and it's very memorable in thinking about that. And being that we're both boat guys, even though I do prefer the power versus the wind, but that gave me a lot of perspective thinking about the way you frame that, because that's really how business is. And especially with how AI is going to impact everyone in the coming years. In the coming months, I think that that's a great analogy. Steve, what's one thing you hope our listeners take away from this incredible body of work we built together over the last 11 years?
Well, we talk a lot about Make Big Happen. Again, that's the name of a couple of the books here, name of the podcast. And to me, Make Big Happen is not like one breakthrough idea. It's not one viral moment. It's not like just one little piece of magic. To me, it's more about, and I relate it to the idea of mastery. So I'm really big into thinking of this concept of mastery, which is simply that you do the work. You show up every day. Even when it doesn't look like you're making a lot of progress, you're there putting in the miles. You're in there putting in the reps. And I know, Mark, you're a triathlete guy, so you know all about that. You know about all that hard work. And there may be times when you're going backwards. But to make big happen, you've got to be in there. You've got to show up. You've got to do all the things. You've got to have the cadence. And so what I hope listeners take away is just that idea that Make Big Happen isn't about some single breakthrough idea. It's about doing all those little things just right, day after day, showing up, making adjustments along the way. And then one day you're going to wake up and you're going to realize, oh my goodness, I actually did make big happen.
I love it. Steve, you've helped over the years shape how thousands of leaders think about building their businesses. And I just want to say a huge, huge, huge thank you to you for all those who followed you, listened to you, learned from you, and grown because of you on this show. A huge thank you for me, and a huge thank you on behalf of all of our listeners for the impact that you have had on their businesses and their lives. And this is not the end of the Make Big Happen podcast. This is the beginning of a new era of the podcast, with saying thank you to you and with me coming in as its new host leading this podcast from this point forward. I hope you will come back and let me interview you again. It was fun having the opportunity to do this with you here today. Any final words for our community at CEO Coaching International before we close this wonderful chapter?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you. It's been a huge privilege for me to be able to do this for 11 years and to even spend more time with you and the team at CEO Coaching, and then all the amazing people that I've had the opportunity to interview and talk to over the past 11 years has just been phenomenal. So it's been a great, great privilege for me, and I very much appreciate that opportunity that you've given me, Mark. The other thing that I would say is, after interviewing all these people, it reinforced in me the idea that you don't have to be born with a silver spoon in your mouth. It's like anybody can be as successful as you want to be in this country, in this world. And I've interviewed people that started with absolutely nothing. And Mark, you're a great example. I mean, you started from a small town in Canada, right? And look at you now. I mean, you know, the success that you and the team have built here, multiple business over time, is just incredible. And so it doesn't matter where you start. Yeah, some people may have a little bit of a head start, totally understand that. But if you have the desire, if you have the ability to stick to it, if you have this mastery mindset where you know, I'm going to show up, I'm going to do the work, I'm going to adjust, I'm going to learn, I'm going to ask for help, I'm going to build a team, you keep doing that and you're going to be successful. So I'm very optimistic about the opportunity that people have ahead of them. And as far as the show goes here, Mark, I am thrilled to turn the mic over to you, and I'm excited to see where the podcast is going to go in the future. But one thing I do know, the program is in great hands with you. So again, appreciate everything, Mark.
Well, I know, Steve, I got big shoes to fill following you. I'm grateful for you. I'm grateful for our friendship of many, many years. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. We'll miss you. And I look forward to having you back.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
There are three kinds of people: those who make big happen, those who let things happen, and those who ask what happened. Don't just listen to these stories. Decide who you're going to be. Show notes and resources are available at CEOcoachinginternational.com. Subscribe so you don't miss what's next. At some point, every leader faces a choice. Play it safe or go big. If you're ready to make big happen, visit CEOcoachinginternational.com and learn how our been there, done that CEO coaches can help you make big happen.